That warmth and tone at the keyboard reflected his reliably warm personality, often on display in the role he developed as educator. Here in 1996, he responds to a middle school student's question about why he's so interested in jazz.
I can play what I feel using that kind of music as a means to do that.
His jazz advocacy became at least as significant as his playing. And his long radio and TV career ranged from a local station in Harlem to CBS, public TV, and NPR. Billy Taylor also helped found Jazzmobile in the 1960s, mobile outdoor concerts bringing music to inner-city neighborhoods. Paul Brown, NPR News.
And I'm Craig Windham, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at kauffman.org.
Hey, how'd you like to help this radio station and spiff up your driveway at the same time?
What are we doing, going into the paving business once again?
No, it's Car Talk's new vehicle donation program where you donate a car. The proceeds benefit this station, and you tuck it to the IRS at the same time.
Hat trick!
And you can do it all on the web.
To learn more, call 866-789-8627. Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers of the new Champaign County YMCA and Larkin's Place at the Y, on the web at ratioarchitects.com. Ratio Architects encourages you to join them in supporting WILL.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. In the early 1970s, Jack Anderson was America's most famous investigative reporter, and in his work, he made many powerful enemies. And at the top of that list was Richard Nixon. The people in the Nixon White House tried everything that they could think of to discredit Anderson, and eventually they even plotted to murder him. This morning, we'll be talking with Mark Feldstein, and he'll tell us the story of the long battle between Jack Anderson and Richard Nixon. He writes about this in a recently published book, which he titles Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. Ferris Strauss and Giroux is the publisher, and the subtitle suggests the other major theme of his work. He makes the argument that in many ways, the personal struggle between these two men, Anderson and Nixon, helped to shape relations between the president and the news media, and that we can see that today. And Professor Feldstein, hello.
Hi, David. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. You know, I think that right off the bat here, we need to talk about who Jack Anderson was, because I think there are a lot of people listening to us, particularly younger ones, for whom that name won't have much meaning. But you've made a comparison that I think a lot of people today will get, and that is that you've said Jack Anderson was the WikiLeaks of his time. And that's something I think people today will be able to understand.
Well, yes, he was the WikiLeaks of his day, but that almost doesn't do him justice. He was WikiLeaks plus Bob Woodward plus Mike Wallace, and maybe a little Glenn Beck all rolled into one. He was the most famous and most feared investigative reporter. He was like WikiLeaks in the sense that he published classified documents when no other mainstream reporter was doing it in the mid-20th century, 1950s, 1960s. That stuff was taboo. And he would not only publish them in his syndicated column, which ran in 1,000 newspapers, reached as many as 70 million Americans, but he would pass them out, like WikiLeaks does, at news conferences, gleefully handing them out, not with the Internet technology of today, but the lowly Xerox machine was his technological method of distribution. And he got the information out when nobody else would.
Yeah, I was really actually a little surprised to read that as recently as 2004, he was still writing the column.
Well, he was. You know, the column is the longest-running political column in the nation. It started in 1932 when Franklin Roosevelt was president by his predecessor, Drew Pearson. It targeted politicians and corporations at a time through the mid-20th century when journalism was very deferential to those in power. And then with Watergate, that started to change. But they were early on doing not only sort of highbrow public service investigative journalism, but also kind of the lowbrow scandal mongering, investigating sex lives, outing of gay opponents that we also see today. So in many ways, they were the forerunners of the kind of modern tabloid scandal culture that we all know so well today.
Yeah, we can talk about how this relationship or this war between the two men got started and how far it went back. And it certainly even went back before Nixon was elected president. But just to touch touch on the title and one of the levels the title works on, and I mentioned it in the introduction, there was a point where in the Nixon White House, they were so angry with, so frustrated with Anderson that they actually did talk about murdering him.
Well, you're absolutely right, David, and it's one of the most bizarre, overlooked chapters in American political history. On March 24th, 1972, two Nixon men, Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt, met a block from the White House at the Hay Adams Hotel for a lunch rendezvous with a CIA agent, a poison specialist, and they wanted to know what kind of poison they could use on Jack Anderson that would not be detected in an autopsy later so that they could cover their tracks. And the CIA at this time was very heavily involved in experimentation using LSD. That was kind of their drug of choice, if you will, in the 50s and 60s. And their idea was to put LSD on Anderson's steering wheel, on the steering wheel of his car, so he would absorb it through his hands and have a hallucination while he was driving and crash the car and die. The CIA poison expert said that really wasn't a very effective way of administering it. If it was summertime, Anderson's palms could be sweaty and it wouldn't absorb that way. If it was wintertime and he wore gloves, the same problem. And one of his kids or, you know, another family member might be the one driving the car and they'd kill the wrong Anderson. So the CIA guy recommended instead a technique that they used abroad, which is to use another car to crash it and make an automobile flip, Anderson's car flip over, crash and burn, and so he would die, be incinerated that way. So Hunt and Liddy, who were Nixon's men, liked that idea. They then staked, tailed Anderson from his downtown Washington office to his home in suburban Washington to see the driving route that he drove. And they located one particular intersection that was already notorious for having a lot of fatal accidents because it was a kind of difficult rotary to maneuver around. So that was one method they drew up. Then they staked out Anderson's house. They conducted surveillance on it to see how they could break in and where they could break in, the easiest ways of entry into the house to kill him in the house, perhaps putting poison in one of his aspirin bottles. But Gordon Liddy, who was a talk show host now, he was a man of action and he was impatient. And he thought, and Hunt did too, that would take too long. Who knows how long it would take before Anderson got to the poison capsule. And once again, they might poison the wrong member of the family. There was only one Anderson they really wanted to kill, and it didn't do them any good to kill any of the others. So finally, Liddy said that he would personally murder Anderson. He would slit his throat or break his neck and remove his watch and wallet so that it would look like just a regular street mugging of the kind that happens a lot here in Washington. Mm. So they all shook hands, agreed on that, thought that was a good plan, wrote it up in a memo for the White House, and were all primed and ready to do the hit when they suddenly got different orders. They were told there was a more urgent mission, break into the Watergate office building. And, of course, they did that, got arrested, and the regime came crumbling down. So the plot was never put into effect, yeah. But that's what they plotted.
And Liddy and Hunt have both actually admitted to this.
Yes,
they said, yes,
have.
In fact, we did this.
Yeah, yes. Liddy admitted it some years ago was widely dismissed as a crackpot, and Hunt was a bit squirrely at the time about it, but I did do an interview with him before he died, which I tape recorded, where he did, in fact, admit all of this was true and indeed gave me new details that even Liddy hadn't acknowledged before.
Yeah. I guess in the past, I don't know why I didn't. I hadn't really put this together, but I suppose it tells you something about how obsessed with leaks the Nixon White House was. People will recall these people who were involved in the break-in were referred to as the plumbers. Well, they called them that because they were the guys that were supposed to plug the leaks.
Well, that's exactly right. And Nixon was obsessed. He was obsessed with leaks. Well, he was obsessed with many things. Let's face it. He was obsessed with his enemies, and that's what ultimately brought him down. And his enemies were, you know, widespread. But the news media was his number one enemy, and he was obsessed with his press coverage. He went through it daily on a daily basis, talking about that. And his number one enemy, by all accounts, was Jack Anderson. And the plot to murder Anderson, you have to understand, it didn't come out of a vacuum. This was the final culminating plot to retaliate against Anderson after many others before had lesser ones had tried and failed. Many of them, too, involved breaking the law, but none quite so spectacularly as a murder conspiracy.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Mark Feldstein. He teaches media and public affairs at George Washington University. He's also been a correspondent himself, a reporter. He's worked for almost 20 years as an on-air correspondent at CNN, ABC, NBC, and he's the author of a recent book. The title is Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. It's published by Farrah, Straus, and Giroux, and questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. This battle between the two men, Nixon and Anderson, went back some ways. In fact, people, I'm sure, will recall, a lot of people will recall the famous Checkers speech of Richard Nixon, where he talked about the family dog and how he wouldn't give that up, and about how Pat, his wife, just had a good Republican cloth coat. And all of that really had to do with an expose that Jack Anderson was responsible for.
Well, that's absolutely right. And this was the first major clash between the two. They were both young men at the time. And everybody remembers the maudlin, well, maybe not everybody remembers under a certain age, but what's remembered about the Checkers speech is its kind of mawkish, maudlin tone and the changing of the topic to the Cocker Spaniel dog and how he was defending his daughter's dog. In fact, it was, the real story here was the slush fund that Nixon had. It was a kind of institutionalized bribery, as Jack Anderson and his boss Drew Pearson discovered. Nixon was systematically collecting money from big business and corporate interests in California while he was carrying water for them in Congress. And as despite Nixon's denials, he was in fact using that money for his own personal benefit. So that was a major scandal and a disqualifying one, potentially. But Nixon's kind of brilliant, if humiliating, speech saved his career, and it endeared him to a hardcore base in the Republican Party, even as it alienated liberal Democrats. And that kind of polarization in Nixon's public persona would really last the rest of his career and would foreshadow the kind of polarization that we now see in Washington. Yeah.
Well, you also make the argument that Anderson's writing about Nixon's financial dealings was very important in Nixon's defeat in his run for the presidency.
Well, that's right. Anderson continued to dog Nixon after the Checkers speech in the 50s. He exposed, and again with Drew Pearson, mafia money that Nixon was collecting from his congressional campaigns. And again, that would have been something that would have just, it didn't get picked up by most of the rest of the press, but Nixon was indeed collecting directly and through his aide, Murray Chotiner, money from the mafia, from a gangster named Mickey Cohen. In 1960, he did yet another expose, also involving money, this time from Howard Hughes. And again, it was, under the table kind of bribe money. Nixon was a relatively man of relatively modest means, and his acceptance of cash like that from various players with stakes in Washington. There was also a mob lobbyist for Somoza, the dictator of Nicaragua, that Nixon was pocketing money from, and I lay all this out in my book. These were, you know, really devastating financial scandals. The one particularly on the eve of the 1960 election, it was so tight. It was Nixon versus John Kennedy. And, you know, widely the debates, the televised debates are heralded as determining the outcome. But in fact, what I found in very little known scandal, a story about how there was this Watergate-like break-in that involved the Kennedys and Jack Anderson and Drew Pearson. And the Kennedys, this break-in led to a bunch of documents being filched in Los Angeles that proved Nixon was getting payoffs from Howard Hughes, the billionaire industrialist. And they were there was a payoff made to one of the accountants who helped supply the paperwork, and the documents were leaked to Jack Anderson. And this election eve stink bomb was released about the payoff that Nixon believed and many of his aides believed was the thing that really cost him that election. Mm. So Nixon carried this grudge ever after, and this is what led to the roots of Watergate, his belief that this kind of break-in and bugging. Jack Anderson had been involved in a celebrated bugging incident of his own a couple years earlier in Washington, that these kind of dirty tricks were common in Washington, and Nixon decided he would develop the same kind of dirty tricks apparatus that his enemies had. And this ultimately, of course, would lead to his downfall.
Yeah. I think part of the value of the book is simply to introduce people to this individual, to Jack Anderson, someone that I'm sure a lot of people either don't know about or wouldn't be able to tell you very much about. And so you explore his life and his career. And one of the things that you write about that's interesting is that these two men who grew to have this incredible, intense rivalry, in at least in their roots, were really quite similar, although that then their personalities seem to take these two fundamentally very different kind of directions.
Well, that's right. You get an A. You've obviously read the book and absorbed the lessons. Nixon and Anderson were, you know, despite their mutual hatred, had very similar childhoods. They were born 30 miles apart in Southern California, and they were each raised. Anderson's family moved soon thereafter to Utah. He was raised as a fundamentalist Mormon, just as Nixon was raised as a fundamentalist Quaker. And in the early, you know, 1900s, both of them went to church, you know, all day on Sunday, and you know, were really very observant. They both had volatile authoritarian fathers, and the way they handled their fathers spoke much toward their personality and the way they would conduct themselves in Washington years later. Nixon would manipulate and maneuver around his father to try to placate him and get his way. Anderson would openly defy his father, and so Anderson developed this subversive streak, this hatred for authority and the abuse of power, that would last the rest of his lifetime, the rest of his career, and would manifest itself in his muckraking. Nixon, on the other hand, found that deceit was his best weapon growing up, dealing with his father, and he would, in fact, use that for the rest of his political career. So they both, you know, went to sea during World War II in the South Pacific, and they both returned afterwards in 1947. They both moved to Washington to realize their larger ambitions, and the tactics they would use to rise to power, the slash-and-burn attacks that made them famous, for both of them became wrapped inside a kind of self-righteous demeanor that belied the nastiness of some of the tricks they would use.
Yeah. As you mentioned, for many years, Jack Anderson wrote this column called The Washington Merry-Go-Round, which had been started by Drew Pearson, another very famous name in Washington journalism. Were there some important ways in which Pearson was a mentor for Jack Anderson?
Yes, very much so. all that Jack Anderson became really was learned at Pearson's knee. Pearson was also a Quaker, but unlike Nixon, he was a pacifist, progressive Quaker from Pennsylvania, not the more evangelical strain, that conservative strain that Nixon grew up with in Southern California. And Anderson learned the dark arts of Washington: bribery, blackmail, bugging, burglary, forgery, some of these unsavory techniques at Pearson's knee. And Pearson really trained him, although Anderson did not possess the same kind of education or pedigree or ideological fervor that Pearson did. But he certainly learned the dark arts of Washington from his boss.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have someone here in Champaign County where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was already formulating this sort of question, and something you said provoked me to get in early here, because you sort of made the implication that Nixon was just doing what all what many journalists were doing, sort of. And it seemed to me that I was going to ask, isn't this just more blowback of the U.S., you know, machinations, intelligence, assassinations around the world? In 76, so-called Year of Intelligence, where the Church Commission and the Pike Commission, you know, did analysis of this, it led to, you know, the so-called ban on political assassinations of world leaders, et cetera. Among many other things, but it seems to me that this is blowback from a culture of that kind of machinations that was brought home. I'd also, since you did mention the Watergate and the burglars, there is one theory championed by a Greek journalist who says that one of the factors of the break-in was to see how much, and you already mentioned political scandal from Hughes of money, that there was some sense that they wanted to know what the Democrats knew about money coming from the Greek junta.
Well, your knowledge is impressive, and the Greek junta was indeed one of several foreign dictatorships, as well as you know, a huge number of corporations that was funneling money to the Nixon reelection campaign in '72. And there is that Greek theory that, but most people think, most historians have focused largely on the Hughes money as the main trigger.
I wouldn't say it was the only thing, but it has particular political sort of ramifications in that it's not domestic money. I mean, obviously the Hughes money was foreign money, but when you have international actors who were sort of getting kickbacks because they were involved in,
right,
shipping the oil to the Vietnam War, you know. But this political assassinations were common around the world. And when they come home, I guess the war came home in a lot of different ways. And I would say that.
Well, that's right. And the Church Committee in the years after Nixon's resignation would uncover a lot of the dirty secrets about these foreign assassinations. And in fact, Jack Anderson was the one who first broke the story about the plot to murder Fidel Castro. To my knowledge, the plot to assassinate Jack Anderson is the only one I know of on U.S. soil involving an American journalist, where there was a plot by elements in the government to do that. But there's no question that, you know, the whole growth of the national security state, the Cold War, you know, the after the atomic bomb, led to an enormous increase in secrecy and nefarious plotting by spy agencies, in empire by the U.S. and the kind of imperialism in foreign policy that would lead to some pretty nasty stuff. And we're still seeing it, you know, play its hand out today in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, I want to thank the caller. We're already at our midpoint here. Let me just, before going on to another caller, introduce the guest once again, Mark Feldstein. He teaches media and public affairs at George Washington University, is the author of the recent book, Poisoning the Press: Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and looks at the long-time hostility between these two men, Richard Nixon and Jack Anderson, who was a very important investigative reporter
border in the 1970s, and it looks at all of the things that people in the Nixon White House tried to do to discredit Anderson, and as the title suggestion, as we have discussed, one of the things that they at one point were talking about was actually having him murdered. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's another caller, line number two in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, I this touches a bit on what the previous caller was asking about, I suppose. But one thing that concerns me is, you know, you have these traditionally muckrakers or investigative reporters who are very, very prominent in Jack Anderson's day. And in our day, as you know, there isn't much funding within the news bureaus and so forth for investigative reporting. For people who spend their time doing investigative reporting. And one of my great concerns is that, you know, what I think of as being effective secrecy. In other words, you know, we have no idea what we don't know at this point with the U.S. military, the CIA, and so forth, and of course, the president, presidential administrations and so forth, because they've so effectively weakened whatever achievements were made by the Church Commission and so forth, that it would be very hard to find these things out. Do you actually think that the general climate is actually what that we would find out, you know, if there were attempted murders and so forth, and this kind of scheming, or is it simply that there's just no way to find it out at this point? And when people do, you know, suggest they found things out, it's typically in the form of blogs and so forth, and no one accepts that because they just assume it's unfounded. Not to make suggestions of conspiracy theories and so forth, but I'm just curious as to your view of the current situation with journalism and its relationship, its you know, efforts to investigate at various levels of our national and local governments.
Well, it's a good question, and one I discuss in my book there at the end. I mean, governments have gotten much more effective, all administrations, since Nixon's day, at secrecy, at controlling information and the release of information and classifying it. It's, the secrets. And, you know, in many ways, Nixon was a fluke. He taped himself, so we have an unusual window into the nefarious dealings that went on. Who knows what else went on in other administrations that we don't know about, because there aren't the tapes and there isn't the documentation, and that stuff never sees the light of day. You know, the media has grown feistier since Watergate, since Nixon's rule. They were embarrassed by their own failure during Watergate, particularly the White House press corps, which was so supine. And yet, you know, most of journalism today isn't much more aggressive. You know, there really is no figure like Jack Anderson today with that degree of clout and audience and willingness to kind of cut some corners to dig out the truth. There are a number of fine journalists around, Cy Hirsch, Bob Woodward, you know, from Watergate days to today, and WikiLeaks potentially and the Internet potentially has the ability to get some stuff out, but the government's gotten so much more sophisticated at hiding it that it's hard to know what we don't know.
Well, again, other questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly in doing his work, Jack Anderson benefited greatly from information that was provided to him by people in government. How did he cultivate sources like that, or did he even have to cultivate them?
Well, that's a great question. And part of it was because he was the lone outlier in those days. People in Washington or across the country knew that if you wanted to get some dirt out, Jack Anderson was the only guy who would do it in the mainstream press. And that's not the case today. There are multiple avenues to get it out. So in that sense, he, you know, was an obvious place to send stuff to. And he got a lot of documents in the mail, you know, anonymously. But he was also he was really quite brilliant at the way he worked his sources, the way he would appeal to their higher, to a higher authority than the bosses they worked for, the way he would invoke the idealism of the fact that government workers work for the American people, ultimately, and that, you know, leak these documents is to provide it to their ultimate boss, not the one that happened to sign their paycheck. So, you know, he was very good at working his sources. He was very good at protecting his sources. Unlike WikiLeaks and the New York Times, you know, which recently, you know, ran some critical articles about Julian Assange, Jack Anderson would champion his sources. He would provide them with lawyers to protect them, and he would go to prison rather than identify them. So that, too, was a way he was able to work his sources. He was known for his loyalty.
One indication of the way that he was viewed by people in the media was the fact that the Washington Post ran his column on the comics page. Now, they did run it, but they ran it on the comics page. So that that makes you wonder, well, generally speaking, what other reporters in Washington thought about him?
Not much. And that was no mere coincidence that his column was run on the comics page. That was an editorial put down. And he was looked down upon by the Washington elite journalistic crowd who socialized after hours in Georgetown with you know, the ruling class of Washington. And, you know, they often whispered to each other some of the kinds of stuff that Jack Anderson knew and would write about in their column. But these mainstream journalists didn't publicize it. They didn't publish classified documents. They didn't write about sex lives of politicians. And Anderson was at the forefront of some of that lowbrow reporting as well, the outing, gay outings and so forth. He was doing that decades ago. And the fact that Anderson was an outsider, the fact that he was a Mormon from Utah who never finished college and was looked down upon, actually gave him an independence and a willingness to burn, you know, official Washington sources and power players in a way that the mainstream media didn't do.
One of the things in the this period before they got to the assassination, when the White House, what they were doing was doing things that they would hope would discredit him. One of the things that they floated was this idea that they would suggest that he was gay. And it's pretty striking here that at that time, that was a not an uncommon weapon that people used against their political enemies, the implication or the suggestion or the outright statement that they were gay.
Well, that's right. And in those days, that was, you know, just about the worst thing you could say about somebody. You know, Joe McCarthy campaigned against communists and queers, as he put it. And one was the enemy abroad, the communists, and one was seen as the enemy within, homosexuality. Ironically, McCarthy himself was alleged to have had sex with men, and Jack Anderson was a reporter who managed to get that in his column. He acquired affidavits from men who claimed to have had sex with Joe McCarthy and found a way to get it in the column. Nobody else touched it at that time. J. Edgar Hoover, widely rumored to be gay, but again, mainstream media in Washington wouldn't touch that story then. Jack Anderson did. He wrote about it in his column. He followed Hoover around trying to find evidence of it. He even rifled through Hoover's trash looking for evidence of it. He didn't find that, but he did find empty antacid. So he made sport of Hoover in his column by writing about his gas pains and the flatulence of the FBI, and made Hoover a laughingstock at a time he was feared all across the country. Made Hoover a laughingstock in the eyes even of his aides. So, and homosexuality was a weapon, and Anderson used it, and Nixon in turn used it against Anderson. He became convinced that some of the classified documents Anderson was getting came from a homosexual relationship that Anderson had with one of his sources. It was nonsense. Anderson was a straight arrow Mormon husband, 9 kids, a teetotaler, didn't drink alcohol, didn't drink caffeine, and so was his source, a Mormon in the Navy. But Nixon ordered federal agents to tail Anderson to try to catch him in bed with his source. Never happened. Undeterred, Nixon ordered his staff to smear Anderson as gay anyway. That didn't work. In fact, the Washington Post did an expose about how the Nixon White House was trying to smear Anderson. So, I mean, it's ludicrous, but more than just ludicrous, because in those days, you know, that was a career ender, if it could be proved.
Yeah. Here's another caller, someone in Chicago. Let's talk with them on our line four. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. I find this conversation very interesting because, if you'll recall, if you read the book Advise and Consent, that's exactly what a president did to a senator from Utah, who, by the way, happened to be a Mormon, and he smeared him with a gay scandal, and the senator ended up committing suicide because he opposed the president's appointment for Secretary of State. So I guess it's life imitating art, so to speak.
Well, actually, that Alan Drury novel was based on yet another gay. I mean, it's sort of a fascinating gay subculture and gay history in Washington, Sub Rosa. And there was indeed a senator who committed suicide after the McCarthyites exposed his son for being gay. And back in the 50s, my suspicion is that perhaps that was based on that incident, but I could be wrong on that. I'm not certain of the chronology. But, yeah, life imitates art, and art imitates life. So,
Indeed it does. We know that Hoover, for instance, tried to get something on Martin Luther King.
And that's in my book. And one of the things I found in my book that hasn't come out before is that Hoover was making stuff. Hoover's FBI was making stuff up about King supposedly getting drunk while he was collecting the Nobel Prize in Peace Prize in Oslo, and nakedly chasing some prostitutes through his hotel corridor, and some transcripts of bugs of Hoover of King in bed that are so filthy I can't say the words on the air, although they're in my book. And this smear tactic involving sex was a standard staple of Hoover's repertoire. And after Anderson reported on the gay allegations with Hoover and how Hoover had sex files on all these people and was preoccupied with homosexuality, a few hours after Anderson broke that story in his column, Hoover dropped dead of a heart attack.
Well, you know, it just, I guess this country has been very lucky because we've had demagogues, but they seem to self-destruct at one point.
Yes, they have. There's been some damage along the way, but, you know, and fortunately, we've had an independent press that would expose them at the end, although we've also had people in the press who would conspire with them. McCarthy had his acolytes who in the press who were cheerleaders for him.
Yeah, you know, George Wallace is the only one of those demagogues that I ever know of who went to Martin Luther King's church and said, "I was wrong."
Well, that's true.
A lot of courage.
But I'll tell you, there's an interesting section on George Wallace in my book because for a time, Nixon and Anderson conspired together to get George Wallace. And it's a fascinating chapter how Nixon leaked to Jack Anderson Wallace's confidential tax returns, illegally so. In fact, it was a proposed article of impeachment against Nixon. That helped sideline Wallace to get him out of the way for Nixon's successful reelection.
Well, since I want to thank the caller, by the way, but since we're at this point, we're talking about the Jack Anderson and the FBI, I should ask you to tell the story about what happened to you in 2006 when you were working on your dissertation, your doctoral dissertation, which I think then ends up being this book. The FBI came to your house looking for material that you were using to do this work.
Well, that's right. Bizarre case. A few weeks after Anderson died, in 2006, two FBI agents came by my house, and they flashed their badges, and they wanted to confiscate the archives that Anderson had donated to my university. I had gotten them to do so. And they claimed there was evidence of espionage in his archives. And I was flabbergasted because, you know, I'd been through the archives, and I didn't see any classified documents in there or any, you know, evidence of espionage. They were pretty dusty documents, decades old. Anderson had been ailing with Parkinson's disease for the last 20 years before his death, and I couldn't really see how that was the case. So you know, Anderson's family and my university basically refused this FBI fishing expedition, and it made the front page of the New York Times, and editorial condemnation from Amy Goodman on the left to Fox News on the right, that, you know, the FBI at a time when Osama bin Laden's on the loose, and, you know, there are more high-tech terrorism priorities to be, you know, going after a dead journalist seemed a little much. And the FBI ultimately backed down. But we still don't know why they really were doing that. Was this some kind of revenge by J. Edgar Hoover loyalists in the FBI for Anderson's reporting on Hoover? That's what Anderson's family thought. Was it revenge by Cheney and Rumsfeld, who were at high level, you know, then really kind of running things for the Bush administration and had old battles with Anderson that they wanted to settle in some sort of score settling? Don't really know. But it was a kind of a delicious irony that here Jack Anderson was dead and he's still tormenting the government from the grave, and I can't help but think he was looking down or up from wherever he was and laughing at what fools they were making of themselves yet again, even in death.
Mark Feldstein is our guest. He teaches media and public affairs at George Washington University, and he is the author of the book Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture, published by Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux. In the interest of full disclosure, that not only did you know Jack Anderson, that at one point you actually worked for Jack Anderson.
I did. I was a lowly paid intern in high school and college in the couple of summers in the 1970s. And then I lost touch with him for 20 years and went to grad school, got a PhD after being a reporter, and decided that his story would be a pretty interesting one to write. And I'll let the reader decide whether I've been fair or not. I know the family, the Anderson family, is not happy with some of the things I reported about bribery and blackmail and so forth that he was involved in during his career.
Well, I guess the reason I raised the question of the fact that you did know him and the fact that some of the methods that he used were pretty unsavory and doesn't really, no one I think comes off particularly well here. But that gets to the question, having known him, was he somebody who was likable? What was he like as a person?
Well, you know, he had a private side and a public side, and his private side was very likable, funny, irreverent, humble, modest, you know, a middle-class guy from Utah, you know, kind of a country boy who still retained some of that impish sense of delight. As a public figure, particularly once he became famous, he had a very sort of bombastic persona. Part of it was the sort of self-righteous Mormon missionary persona that he developed while he was doing his mission in the South. It was a fire and brimstone kind of evangelical approach that he would use on the stump to try to win converts in the rural South when he was a Mormon missionary. And that was a bit more off-putting, that kind of crusading persona. But in private, he was actually quite delightful. Mm.
One thing maybe it would tell you something about his sense of humor is this story about how at one point, again, this was before they started talking about assassinating him, they sent CIA guys to spy on him, something which clearly was illegal. He knew about it. He found out about it. And you mentioned that he had all these kids. He apparently sent his kids out to harass the CIA guys.
He did, and it's a hysterical scene, really. It's almost like something out of a movie where the kids, he had these nine kids, and most of them were teenagers, and so he sicked them on the CIA, and they would sneak up from behind on the agents who were spying on them and let the air out of their tires, take their photographs while the agents tried to cover their faces with newspapers. They would dress up, the kids would, to look like their dad, wearing trench coats and a hat and a briefcase, several of them at once, jumping into different cars and screeching off so that the agents wouldn't know which one was Jack Anderson and which ones were the imposters, and didn't know which one to follow. So it was pretty funny, although it was actually, you know, behind the humor, it was rather disturbing. The CIA was doing this illegally, as you say, and 16 agents round the clock, 24/7 surveillance of not only Anderson but his staff, including his young reporter Britt Hume, who later went to Fox News, and his family. So it was a pretty chilling thing, as were some of the other tactics they used against Anderson. Bogus documents they drew up to try to ensnare Anderson in printing false stories. And luckily for him, he had a deep throat in the White House who he could show it to, who said, this looks absolutely like the genuine article. It has all the right routing numbers. Whoever did this had enormous sophistication. But the memo was bogus. It had never been written. And, in fact, the White House tapes I listened to, and they are the gift that keeps on giving. There's so much great stuff in there. They show that Nixon and his aides sat around talking about how to break into Anderson's office and type a memo on Anderson's own typewriter, on White House letterhead, that they would feed to him and expose not only as false, but as typed on Anderson's typewriter, as if Anderson himself had concocted the memo to get Nixon, when it was exactly the other way around.
Well, we're coming down to the point where we have about 5 minutes, and we've been talking a lot about Anderson, and he himself is a great story. But I want to make sure that we, at least before we finish up, devote a couple of minutes to the other kind of argument that you're making in the book and the other level at which this title, Poisoning the Press, works. Because you really make the argument that some, at least some, maybe much, of the atmosphere in Washington today, the fact that there is an awful lot of energy devoted towards talking about scandal and uncovering scandal, and the relationship between the media and the president can be sometimes very difficult. You say that a lot of the foundation for what we have now was laid at this point that we've been talking about.
Well, yes, and I don't want to oversimplify. Obviously, there have been enormous changes, technological changes with the development of cable news and satellite and the Internet, which has led to a proliferation of media outlets. It's led to a decline of ratings and revenue for the mainstream outlets, so they've started tarting up the news in this tabloid fashion. But, you know, those are the larger causes. But, you know, Anderson was an outlier in his day and looked down upon. But really, mainstream media has come to imitate many of the methods that he used, going through garbage, exposing private lives of public figures, that kind of thing. And at the same time, Nixon, as crazy as he was, politicians have imitated many of the things he pioneered. The White House propaganda machine that he started has been mastered by every subsequent administration. The daily message that the White House would put out of the day is something all White Houses have followed. The attack rooms and war rooms and nasty political ads, again, that all harks back to Nixon's White House. And Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Karl Rove, they all got their start with Nixon. And so we are still in many ways living with the legacy of this battle between these two long-deceased men.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because I guess I would have thought that that the administration that really learned how to manipulate the media and did it very well and set the model, I think of that as being a Reagan kind of thing.
Well, Reagan was the master, no question about it. But it was Nixon's people, in many ways, who who brought these strategies and built upon the ones that Nixon started, with a much more appealing actor at the helm. You know, Reagan was much more likable and easier to package, and was a professional actor who knew his lines. Nixon, in many ways, was a very awkward and unappealing character for that. But he was the brains behind it. I mean, Fox News was his idea, a fourth conservative network that his television guru, Roger Ailes, would, you know, put into place a generation later.
That's also something that I thought was fascinating that I didn't know, that it was Nixon actually had this idea that what this country really needed was another network to challenge those that no doubt he thought were liberal, and he thought, well, let's make one. And he actually he talked with Howard Hughes about bankrolling this?
He did indeed, and I am super impressed, because that's in a footnote of my book. So you get an A+. That's exactly right. Howard Hughes, his financial benefactor, financial angel, he talked about it with. And so Nixon was really very much the brains in many ways and spiritual father of all that has come to pass. And liberals might well see this as Fox News as Nixon's ultimate revenge. So we are still very much living in the legacy of these two men and the kind of Washington scandal culture that we all know today so well and don't necessarily like is very much a product that was set in motion by what happened a generation ago.
And having said all that, though, I think it's probably also true to say that there's really no one today like Jack Anderson, and maybe never will be.
No, I think that's right. Just media itself has become so decentralized. No single figure has that kind of audience or that kind of clout. And there are many kind of elements of Jack Anderson, little mini Jack Andersons here and there. But, you know, I wish we had someone like him. For all his faults, he kept public officials accountable at a time when no one else was, and he brought to light secrets that no one else did. And the country is better for it. And I wish we had more journalists like him today exposing the wrongdoings that we don't even know about.
Yeah. It sounds like I talked earlier about the fact that I was really actually kind of surprised to learn that as recently as 2004, I think it was, he was still riding Washington merry-go-round. And it was not long after that that he passed away, really long after the time of his great influence. It sounds as if his latter years were maybe not very good ones.
No, they weren't. They were actually pretty tragic. Not just that he was sick with Parkinson's and cancer and debilitated, but you know the supreme irony is Watergate displaced him. I mean that Watergate happened. His enemy, who he had stalked for 25 years, like Ahab with the great white whale, gets harpooned, and two young reporters, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, get the credit for it, deserved or not, and. Here he had been on the forefront doing all this risky investigative stuff, and he's forgotten by history. And suddenly now he has this enormous competition for the first time because now investigative reporting is fashionable. It's not just Woodstein at the Post. It's Cy Hirsch at the New York Times, Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes. Everybody's doing it, and the monopoly he once had on investigative reporting disappears. So he responds by doing increasingly more tabloid, more reckless and sloppy journalism, and his career really goes into a tailspin.
There, we'll have to leave it. It's a great story. The book, again, is Poisoning the Press. It's published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. Our guest, Mark Feldstein, is the author. He teaches at George Washington University. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website. Anytime that you're ready to listen, just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
WILL programs are made possible with support from Lincoln Square. Starting as one of the nation's first enclosed malls, Lincoln Square is now evolved into a mixed-use lifestyle center. Information on business space and future development projects is available at 217-367-4092. Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where finally it does appear that after 10 straight days of higher highs, futures for corn appear headed for a setback today. Corn prices have dipped and are down almost double digits at this point in the session, although there are some concerns remaining about crop conditions in Argentina during the pollination period among traders. And we also got a report from the agriculture minister out of China who says that corn harvest rose by more than 10 million tons in 2010, but that China will no longer have surplus corn supplies because of the rapid expansion of its corn processing and animal feed production, that according to its vice agriculture minister. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars. We'll begin in Kansas City, where March wheat is 844 down 13 and 3 quarters, May 853 and a quarter down 13 and a quarter, July 858 and a quarter down 13 and a quarter. March wheat at the Board of Trade 781 down 18 and a quarter, May 807 down 18 and 3 quarters, July 818 and a quarter down 18. March corn 614 and 3 quarters down 9 and a quarter, May 622 and 3 quarters down 9 and a quarter, July 626 and a half down 9 and a quarter, September 582 down 5, December 550.